Hello, everybody, and welcome to True Crime Banter, the podcast aimed at bringing you your dose of murder relaxation. So just sit back and enjoy. Hello, everybody. Whoa, welcome. Welcome.
It's the sound of pure excitement.
Oh, hello, everybody, and welcome to the True Crime Banter podcast.
OMG.
This is...
I missed you.
Embarrassing.
Not you, I meant the people.
Oh, yeah.
No, I've never said that about
you. Hey, everyone.
Hi.
Long time no podcast
episode. Long time no talky talk.
Hi. Yeah, it's been... A minute.
Many a minute.
As you would say.
Mm-hmm.
Did you want to wish any happy holidays to anybody?
Yeah, all of them. All the ones that everyone celebrates.
What was it? Halloween, Thanksgiving.
Groundhog's Day.
Groundhog, that's recent.
Which I just saw.
Early spring.
Early spring, yo.
Ooh, you know what that means.
Early
More
spring.
Episodes.
Okay. Well, yeah, maybe, hopefully. No.
Yeah,
Christmas, Kwanzaa, all the things.
Hanukkah.
New Year's, all the things.
Old years.
Mm-hmm.
I made that stupid
Do
joke.
Do you have any updates for the peeps?
I don't think
Nothing?
So.
Nothing? No, I don't either.
No, but there, you know what? I've got a bit of banter for some people.
Ooh.
Real fast. This is a game that people can play at home.
Okay.
This is not a game we're going to be playing now. This
okay.
is something that we did a few weeks ago. And we found a movie that we knew was absolutely cringy, but the guess, but the game is to guess how far into the movie the cringe begins. And for us, we saw the movie Twilight on Hulu.
Yeah,
maybe?
It just popped up.
Something popped up. And we were like, oh, God.
Yeah.
I think you said something like, how long until like you wouldn't be able to watch it anymore?
Right.
And I was like, you know what? Let's press play and guess.
Bets, yeah.
And it took like 9 minutes and 40 seconds.
It was
like
right
like
in the middle of both of our bets.
Yeah.
You did like 7 minutes, I did like 10 or something. Yeah.
And if
so
people were
quick.
Wondering, it was like the first scene of
so bad, you guys.
Taylor
so
Lautner
bad.
And his long fucking hair.
Ugh.
So there's my bit of banter. It's a fun game that I think maybe we should do more with some movies. Like, you know, just...
Other shitty ones,
Whoa.
Twilight 2, Twilight 3.
All the Twilights. So, yeah, that's all we've been doing is just watching all the Twilights.
No.
back to back. Anyways, we're back. We got a new episode. Lo and behold, unbeknownst to anybody, I'm just saying words, but you did the research on this one.
Yes.
Once again. And.
Yeah.
I think we're just going to get right into it.
Yep, here we go. Celebrating Christmas as they always did. The big and close-knit family spent the day opening presents and ended with a big holiday dinner. One of the children, 20-year-old Kara Knott, was making plans for the following day as the evening came to an end. Kara and her high school sweetheart, Wayne, were about a 45-minute drive from each other, with Wayne being in Escondido and her being in San Diego. But she had done this drive so many times, she didn't mind and excitedly packed for the weekend. Wayne had called, though, and told her that he wasn't feeling well. But instead of staying home all weekend by herself, she wanted to go visit him and help take care of him for a few days. Obviously, it's 1986, so there's no cell phones, but Kara was really good about calling and checking in before and after her trips to see Wayne, making sure her family knew where she was so they wouldn't worry. So by the 27th, a couple days later, when Wayne felt better, she called home around 8:30 that night and said that she was headed back and she would be home soon. Before hitting the road, though, she stopped by a local Chevron station to fill up, and then headed out on the freeway like she always did. An hour later, her parents, Sam and Joyce, were looking at the clock and feeling a bit uneasy, but being 15 minutes late could be for many reasons, so they waited a little bit longer just in case. Once an hour and a half went by, though, they were up and ready to find her. This was not like her at all, so something was clearly keeping her from being home. Her father, Sam, said he got a physical feeling in his stomach that something was very wrong, and that's when it all became real to him. With a couple phone calls, her parents and siblings were all out driving around trying to spot her car along the stretch of freeway that she always used. This wasn't a situation of her taking multiple back roads or some alternate route. There was the only route that she could take was the freeway for that 40-minute drive, and it was a straight shot. So if she had pulled over, somewhere with car trouble or something like that, she would have been easy to see. After hours of searching, her family decided to take a break, but headed right back out when the sun came up. Unfortunately, their second search came to a quick end at 5 a.m., when Kara's older sister and her husband were out looking off an old exit, and there at the bottom, they found Kara's abandoned white Volkswagen Beetle. They had been driving back home when they decided to check Mercy Road, an exit that nobody used, and for good reason. It was known for some pretty shady activity. Even cops didn't go there, saying, quote, "they always got a creepy feeling." Police were immediately called, and once on scene, they found her keys in the ignition, the driver's side window about halfway down, her credit card and gas receipt on the passenger side seat, and her personal belongings in the back. Any theories, though, that they might have had were short-lived, because searchers that had found out quickly spotted a body under the nearby bridge. It didn't take long to identify it as Kara. At the time, her family was nearby, and once they saw the commotion, her father walked up to the group of men who had just discovered his daughter's body and asked if it was her. The officer said yes, it was Kara, and that they were sorry. Sam said, "I'm sorry too. I wish you could have known her. She was an angel."
They sent her body off for an autopsy, but what they gathered upon finding her was crucial. Strangulation marks were obvious, and a big gash was found on her head. This was obviously more than just falling off a bridge. This scene made absolutely no sense. Above where her body was found, up on the bridge, were tire skid marks. The investigators measured the width and dimensions and logged it away, hoping that maybe, just maybe, it would come in handy later down the road. They didn't have much physical evidence, but they did the groundwork and looked deeply into her boyfriend, Wayne. They couldn't find any proof that he had left his house after she did that evening. Everybody loved Wayne, and his record was spotless. Kara and Wayne had a great relationship. He would have no reason to follow her and kill her. So while police chased down tips and interviewed a number of people, the news station had its own plan. With the San Diego area shocked by Kara's murder, and while her family mourned, many locals tried to come to terms with the fact that their area wasn't quite as safe as they once thought it was. The Mercy Road exit wasn't unknown to law enforcement, and this was not the first time a body had been found there either. Difference is, the other victims all had backgrounds involving drugs or prostitution. Not that that makes anything okay, but the public was worried that someone like Kara, who led a very low-risk lifestyle, ended up a victim. So who was to say that anyone else wasn't going to become a victim either? At the time, there was too much panic and not enough assurance, so in this response to this, a local news channel decided to put together a segment that walked the public through what to do at night if you are out on the road. Starring in this news segment was Highway Patrolman Craig Pyre. In this news piece, his job was to walk people through tips for safe driving at night, what to do when pulled over, and how to keep you and your family safe if anything was to happen while out on the streets. The public had some great feedback from this news piece that was put out, and many people thanked them for helping them feel safer while driving at night. What nobody expected, however, were the many number of phone calls from females who couldn't help but recognize Craig Pyre. These women were putting two and two together, recognizing not only Pyre's face, but also the location that Kara was found. Woman after woman called in with their own tale of being pulled over and driven down Mercy Road by none other than Craig Pyre.
Attorney Bob Grimes, who worked closely with the victims of Pyre, said over 30 women came forward after this new segment aired, and they all said that they had been pulled over late at night by Pyre himself. They all had a pretty similar story, saying that they had been escorted down the Mercy Road exit, where they were then told that they had committed a traffic violation when they hadn't, or it was so minor that it didn't warrant a traffic stop. Some of them even said Pyre got out of his vehicle and hopped in their car to question them, where he proceeded to ask them very inappropriate and sexual questions. These calls couldn't be ignored, so the investigators discreetly started looking into Pyre, making sure to not give anything away since they worked so closely with him. They found that he had been writing a traffic ticket at 9:20 p.m. some miles away at the time that they believed Kara had been murdered. At the time, this counted as an alibi, even though the logbook showed his time and whereabouts were written by Pyre himself in a notebook, where anyone could easily change something or lie. Thankfully, the investigators kept going, triple-checking everything just to be sure. Since he had been on duty the night that Kara was killed, he was pulled in for an interview. They were hoping to question him without obviously pointing him out as a suspect. The investigators immediately noticed scratch marks on his arm and face, looking like he had been in some sort of fight. His reasoning was that he had, quote, fallen into a fence that night that Kara was murdered. When he pointed out where he had fallen into the fence, detectives noticed that it would have been extremely unlikely due to the fence's height and the fact that it was located over 20 feet away from where the cars were even parked. At this point, they had nothing definitive, but they asked Pyre to turn over his uniform in the meantime, just in case they needed to test it for anything, and he agreed. While Pyre was still allowed to work and be out on the streets, one of the detectives took a closer look at Pyre's logbook. All the entries were written neat and tidy, all except one, the entry from the night that Kara was killed, the 27th. In that 9:30 time slot, faint but visible erasing marks were present. Had something else been written there beforehand? Had he erased anything? What did he alter? Or was it just a coincidence that the only time he ever messed up in his logbook was the night of Kara's murder? This was added to the list of suspicious findings, but nothing that could really be used against him. Coming forward later, a former co-worker of Pyre's, Steve DeBry, said him and the whole staff were in the break room one day during a meeting, and there was a young woman who was new to the force that had been doing ride-alongs with Pyre. When the news segment came on about the stories of the females calling in, and she had turned around and jokingly said to Craig, "Craig, you did this, didn't you? You even said on our ride-alongs, if you ever killed someone, you'd dump them off the Mercy Road exit." At the time, everyone just laughed it off, but little did they know just how spot on they were.
Okay, so I want to do a quick check-in before we continue the story. I would want to check in with you, but you already know everything
right.
That happened in this. You did most of the research.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you right now, as someone who, I guess you could say is taken in the story for the first time,
yeah.
Quote unquote, immediately I'm like, this cop is fucking a creeper. When you say that you're getting phone calls for the news story
yeah.
that aren't related to what the news story is related to,
yeah,
I think that's something to look into. So,
oh, absolutely. One or two females that call in and have complaints about him could be anything. It could be disgruntled people that were pulled over for a traffic ticket. But the fact that you have like 30 females calling in the second they saw his face.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
So all with the same story. What are the chances?
Yeah, I'm going to let you get back to the story, but okay. I am definitely very intrigued to see
how
this
want.
Plays out.
Yeah. Okay, good. Let's continue then. While police interviewed person after person who knew Kara, victim after victim of Pyers, they were tracking down Kara's last movements of that evening. But what almost nobody knew was that a very hush-hush test was going on. Pyers' uniform was being microscopically examined, and when the analyst got the slide that contained fibers from his gold patrolman arm patch, he froze. He had just seen an identical fiber on a slide from Kara's car. You would think that this would be enough, but further extensive testing had to be done to confirm that this wasn't just an identical match visually, but that the gold fiber had come from specifically Pyers' patch, and the test came back positive. Prosecutors needed more, and they got it. DNA found on Pyers' uniform matched fibers from Kara's clothing as well, proving that they had physical contact with each other when there was absolutely no reason that there should have been. And if that wasn't enough, they found yellow rope in Pyers' patrol car trunk, and when examined forensically, the pattern, width, and fibers matched the marks around Kara's neck.
Finally, prosecutors felt confident in their findings, and 21 days after Kara was found dead under that bridge, Pyers was arrested. When it came time for prosecutors to state their case, they laid out all they had. They presented the rope match they had to the pattern on Kara's neck, then the skin mark they found on the bridge above where she was found, showing the width and length matched Pyers' patrol car to the exact millimeter. The coroner had also found marks on her face that roughly matched the length and width of a police-issued flashlight, showing this is the most likely reason that she got the bruise on her eyebrow and cheekbone. Then, of course, the outstanding DNA evidence found on Kara and Pyers himself, which for 1986 was really good. They gave a story that they confidently believed is what happened that night on the 27th. They said most likely Pyers was out that evening on his shift and had noticed Kara filling up her tank at the Chevron station. This is when he fixated on her, like he had many times before, to the other women. He waited until she pulled under the freeway, and when she was close to Mercy Road, his favorite exit, he put on his lights and used his car speaker to tell her to follow him down the road. When he got out and tried to enter her passenger side, like he had before, Kara refused and he got her out of the driver's side, where she felt threatened and fought back, causing those scratches on his face and arms. This is when he took out his flashlight and struck her in the head, causing those marks and knocking her unconscious. Pyers panicked, knowing she could identify him. He then used the rope in his trunk to strangle her, then placed her on the hood of his car to transport her to the bridge, where she was thrown 70 feet over. By putting her on the hood, they believe he was trying to keep his car clean of any evidence. But when he picked her up to carry her there, the fiber transfer that forensics found had already occurred. Those 21 days of intense detective work paid off, and Pyers was convicted to 25 years to life. He had been denied parole over the years, but is eligible for another hearing in 2027. Kara's father, Sam, made a memorial garden at the spot her body was found, but in the year 2000, he was tending to that garden when he had a heart attack and passed away. Kara's mother, Joyce, is still alive and keeps Kara's memory alive as well, along with her siblings. So there we are. That is the story of Kara Knott.
Yeah. Did you ever hear about this one before?
No.
Okay. I hadn't either. And
Although, sadly, it's like it sounds too familiar to like a lot of other stories out there.
Isn't that so messed up?
Like, this isn't the first time you hear about a police officer taking advantage of, his, I guess, authority.
Right, exactly. And it's a very specific example of something that's very like generalized, like just people in positions of authority, whether it's a teacher or someone like, you know, anyway, we could go on all day about that, but I'm sure he's not the only one, but I had never heard of this, but the reason that I chose this one, it's on my list of ones to cover, but I keep like mentally coming back to this one because I'm like, what is that one with the guy who was like a patrol guy or a cop or whatever? And every time, my dad's the one to be like, oh, yeah, that's the Craig Pyer one. And I'm like, yeah, because he's the one that told me about it. But he has a little story. And this is, he told me this years and years and years ago before this podcast was even a thought.
Okay.
When he was in high school, because my dad grew up in California.
Yeah, I'm intrigued.
Where this happened. Yeah. And 1986, right? So my dad was in high school. It's like sophomore or junior, whatever, because he was born in 1970. And for a class that it was like some kind of law class that he was taking, they did like a mini field trip kind of thing and went to their local courthouse. Okay. And I didn't know this. Don't laugh at me if this is an obvious fact of the world, but that courthouses are just open to the public. You can go sit in on anything at any time.
Public domain.
Yeah, I didn't know that. So for their class, they would go and choose a random courtroom and then write an article or essay about whatever they sat in on that day. So him and a couple friends just chose a random one, and it was Craig Pyer's.
What the?
And when he went in there, him and his friends went in, it was dead silent, and no one else turned around except for Craig Pyer. So he remembers, like, he reenacts it sometimes, it's funny, but he remembers like him like just slowly kind of like turning his whole body and kind of looking like who just came in.
Yeah.
And the second they turned around, him, you know, my dad and his friends were like, oh my God, that's the guy that's on the fucking news.
Oh my gosh.
And so they were like, of course we have to sit there. But yeah, he just like slowly turned back around, and it was like right in the middle of the court or proceedings or some shit.
I wonder if like that's even an option nowadays, because I think you probably could.
Yeah.
For like a field trip.
Yeah. But he remembers that this was like a not so crucial part of the case. So it wasn't like in the middle of like the prosecution, in the defense. It was like they were still picking out like jury members or something, because there wasn't a ton of people up front.
Interesting.
It was like the judge and just the defense lawyer and him, and then a couple people sitting in. But it was enough where he could clearly see through like straight to the front. So it wasn't crowded or anything. But
Because this isn't like it's I guess you would consider a pretty high profile case for that area.
Right.
So
I mean, they must have kept it pretty hush because there was like not a lot of people there. But anyway, he just remembers like before he even made the connection who it was, this guy turning around and looking straight into my dad's eyes as a 16-year-old, he was like literally like just frozen, got the chills. And then it wasn't until a couple minutes later, he was like, holy shit, I know that guy. Yeah.
That's pretty rare, I feel like.
Yeah,
to have a story of someone that has like a first person encounter with someone that.
And so over the years, he's been like, oh yeah, remember that one guy I saw? Whatever.
Of course.
And he doesn't remember the name. He doesn't remember the name though. He's like, there's that one guy in California. He's so bad with names.
Okay.
Then once this podcast became a thing, he was like, do you ever think about doing it about that guy? And I was like, oh yeah. So that's just a little tie in. But if it wasn't for that, I would not know about this. And even during research, there's not a lot out there.
Yeah, there isn't.
Yeah.
I mean, this case, like, to get back to the case, it seems pretty significant. I don't know. So you were talking about how the dad got, like, the law change for how long it takes to report a missing person, you know, over the age of 18, right?
Yeah.
Is that for the state of California?
At least?
Okay.
Yeah.
Like, that's a big deal.
I know.
I mean, there's still, I feel like, states nowadays that don't have that.
And it said in the article that I read, it said that it specifically mentioned you can report somebody immediately who's over the age of 18. So that doesn't make sense to me because minors are immediately reported anyway. So I don't know. People under 18 is immediate, like, flags go up, like you start sending people out anyway. So
yeah, which
I don't know why that was like specified
the Amber Alert type stuff. Right. Where, again, sadly, it's always like a case that changes the law, but it's like it. Thank goodness.
Yeah.
You know, it's I wonder how much goes into recognizing her vehicle, like a white Volkswagen Beetle. I know they're super popular.
Yeah.
Still vehicles, but like. Did it make it more noticeable to be like, that's her car?
Yeah.
Versus like if it was any other, you know.
That's true. And but then, I mean, also too, I mean, if they saw, even if she had like
a
Subaru
too,
or whatever, you know, they'd be like, oh, my daughter drives
I think
a
that's
Subaru.
Her car. Yeah. And she's been missing for the last day or two. And
well, then you get down there and it's abandoned. You're like, this isn't good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you just go into the this is like stuff going through my head when I'm listening to this and. It's a straight shot from the boyfriend's to here. Like, if he lived anywhere else, who knows?
Right.
You know, it's, or if it was anybody else where this wasn't a straight shot, they, you know, they shouldn't be there in the first place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know. Just, that's a super sad one. And you, just like you said, it's a story that you've heard a bunch, you know, just, it's just a different name, different face, but same story. But
yeah, I am. On some of, just to close this out on some of the, like, different articles, you know how, like, people can leave, like, comments on news articles, I guess, or, like...
Yeah, like, at the very
the
bottom.
News Tribune, I don't know if that's still a thing, but one of them, one person said, yeah, my grandparents and my mom, kind of like your dad, were around during this time in San Diego, and my grandparents write in every year... Or anytime he's up for parole, they write in to be like, don't.
Yeah.
Don't let him out. Because they're, I'm assuming they're thinking this could have been our daughter. So.
And he's like mid to late 70s now. Yeah. So, I mean, I'm hoping just because of his age, I'm not writing him off. But I'm hoping that.
He's not a threat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If he does get out. And most of the time they end up changing their name anyway and moving away. But I don't know.
Well.
Yeah. So that's a super fucked up sad case of care not. Yeah.
Yeah.
But. On a lighter note,
we're back.
Yeah, we're back. We missed you guys. Thank you. Side note, thank you to all the people.
Yeah, you were
that
saying
that message
a lot of
saying that you guys are so excited we're back. You guys are so cute. Forever you excited are, I'm way more excited.
Can I just say when I was setting up all this equipment again to start recording? Yeah.
You forgot how to do
there
it.
There was so much dust all over this because we we've been doing a lot of things changed up at home and construction
little
work
projects
per se, but, and one of them involved a lot of like sanding and dusting. Mm-hmm. It was all over this. I was
this
nice is embarrassing.
Dust it off.
And that was like months ago. So I apologize everybody, but
well hopefully now I'll be squeaky clean cuz we'll use it all the time.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And I'm excited. I'm glad to be back. I'm not the big social media person over here on our end. I mean, not that we, either of us
I'm just the only person on it. I'm not
the
big.
You're the one that does everything for us here. So I'm very happy to hear that you guys are very supportive. And I can't wait to start putting out more content for you guys. So
well, thanks, guys. Let us know what you think about this one. And as always, write in stuff that you want us to... you know, talk about or whatever. I'm always like writing down. I have like a little list in my phone of cases that you guys will send in, but maybe this story sparks another one you've heard of that is kind of, you know, so just write it in.
Yeah. Or whatever you guys got, just send it our way.
But anyways.
All right. Well, that's been another episode of the True Crime Banter podcast. Mm-hmm. We'll talk to you next time.
Bye.
Adios.